happy birthday to John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining me.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is 7:59, and coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
Let me tell you the story of a soldier named Dan.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Art of the Protest Song, Sunday, November 12th at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland. The Art of the Protest Song partners the Oregon Historical Society with four local folk musicians to present a showcase of popular and topical protest songs from the Kennedy era, as well as original songs focused on contemporary issues. This event is free and open to the public. Again, that's the Art of the Protest Song, Sunday, November 12th at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Faces without hope and without homes. And the guns they grow.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. After the Smoke Clears is the first in a series of educational public forums on the Eagle Creek Fire and learn how our community can support the recovery of the Columbia River Gorge. The series will feature a combination of multimedia presentations on what happened in the fire and examinations of key challenges moving forward, featuring insights from a collection of noted fire ecologists, forestry researchers, and leaders from local businesses, conservation, and recreation organizations. Again, that's After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Wore black and I wore white. He would always win the fight. Bang, bang. He shot me down. Bang, bang. I hit the ground. Bang, bang.
Yeah, bang, bang. I'm sorry. I know that it's probably insensitive of me, but I am feeling very insensitive these days. Hey, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Abe's on his way, rushing through the traffic, trying, I'm sure, to get here on time. It's KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Number to call, 231-8187. It's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. And we do want to hear from you, and I particularly would like to emphasize the need for new voices. We've got a lot of good people, and I want to compliment a lot of the callers on their very good analysis. But it would be better and more interesting if we have a lot of newer voices, just every now and then, at least. And I'm particularly also interested in hearing from women. I know that, in general, the demographics of talk radio favor men over women, but it doesn't have to be that way. And we really would like to see, hear more ideas, more thinking, more argument, etc. So I have a list of stuff, but what I'm going to primarily, and what Abe and I are going to primarily talk about is the incredible, how do you want to call it, the epidemic of gun violence that's taking place right now and the resistance to making rules against, I mean, just the most common and obvious things, those stocks that allow a semi-automatic weapon to be turned into an automatic weapon, the notion of carrying guns into church, all kinds of things that simply have nothing to do with the Second Amendment and really everything to do with the rationality of human beings, which is questionable, particularly in our odd society. And I have a list of things that I just had to bring up. I couldn't hold my breath and not laugh when Donald Trump, you know, he's president of the United States, when Donald Trump said to the Japanese Prime Minister that it would be just great if the Japanese would make their cars in America. Now, just in case you didn't know this, it's been 20 years since Toyota and Nissan, moved the plants into the South, breaking the United Auto Workers lock on the working class in those industries, but at the same time creating a lot of very well-paying jobs in the context of that region. And that was, it's been a long time. It's been a long time. Also, of course, these cars are made in Mexico. But Trump, amazing guy that he is, knows nothing about anything except maybe how to rip people off and how to deal with the Russians. And he, you know, he blathers on. It's very embarrassing for the U.S., but then again, hey, it's a democracy, right? Right? Uh-huh. Then there's the tenancy of capital, which was talked about by Karl Marx and has been talked about by a variety of analysts, for capital to tend to concentrate and grow bigger and bigger and dominate more and more of all kinds of markets. And we're seeing that right now in the tech industry with Qualcomm and Broadcom actually merging, all kinds of mergers going on. The Russian involvement, the Russian investments in America and vice versa, and the way in which is becoming more and more clear, the Russians essentially had a powerful manipulative effect on the last election. Now, that is not to say that Donald Trump didn't win the presidency. In reality, under our system, he did. And probably more important than that, it unveiled the hardcore 40, more likely 30% of American people who vote, virtually all of them white, who believe absolutely in a model of the United States that has its precedent only in the 19th century. And in that context, the terrible, terrible fears that we see among the working and middle class white populations, not at the coasts, but in the major markets and the major places in the Midwest and so on. The scary thing. I want to talk about also the obvious role in the Republican Party of Russian, anti-Russian and Russian dog whistles, racist dog whistles on the part of the Republicans. Hey, Abe.
I blame Trump.
You blame Trump?
Yeah.
You blame Trump.
Yeah, things used to move faster before he was elected. Traffic, everything. Yeah,
everything was better?
Everything was better.
Sun rose earlier,
that's
set
right.
later.
Birds sang more sweetly.
Oh, it was right. a good time. I just played the Bang Bang, I Shot You
I
Down.
I heard it, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been listening.
So, good for you.
Uh-huh.
So, I think you want, and I think we should, talk a little bit about this. Shall I call it an epidemic, or is it too common to be even called an epidemic?
I think epidemic is exactly the right word, because what we're talking about here really isn't a constitutional issue. It's not an issue of rights. It is an issue of public health. And when you're talking about the health of the public, the term epidemic is incredibly apt. Perhaps the most apt word we could possibly use in this situation.
So it's an epidemic of gun violence.
It's an epidemic of gun violence. Nowhere else in the developed world do we see anything close to either the scale or the regularity of these massacres as we do in the United States? Nowhere else.
Well, that's something to take pride in.
No, Joe. That's a source of deep and abiding shame and fear. Now, let's address that. Let's address that for a moment.
Okay.
We can all wring our hands about how terrible this is. And maybe that was a bad choice of words, because it's terrible. And the grief we all feel is real. But there's something else. There is a growing fear that spreads among the populace. And the baseline of that fear gets ratcheted up every time another one of these massacres takes place. Who now thinks twice when they go to the movies, when they go to a public place? Is this this little voice in the back of your mind going, am I going to have to run for cover? Where are the exits?
Well, I wear my bulletproof vest and my AK-47 strapped to my back, just in case.
Well, yeah, that's true. But that, you know, that's also because you're kind of obnoxious and a lot of people want to shoot you.
But whoa! Don't say things like that!
This is an epidemic. This is corrosive to our society and corrosive to our democracy. The price of freedom, if you want to talk about it in terms of rights, which is what conservatives want to do, is astronomically high at this point. There's a pile of corpses indicating how dearly we buy the freedom to arm ourselves to the teeth in this country. it's my opinion, and I think the opinion of lots of other Americans, that it's not worth it, that it's time to do something.
So you want to do away with the Second Amendment?
Personally, yes. I would like to do away with the Second Amendment.
I don't actually know that that is the route I would take.
It's impossible. It's a non-starter. It's never going to happen.
Well, it's never going to happen, true. But I think also we need to think a little bit about why it was created, what it was about historically, how, you know, when it was written to protect a populace who were making war on Native Americans, who were facing a war with Great Britain, who in and of themselves were kind of an elitist Christian country, as it were, with expectations of having to hunt for food and so on. And in that context, most guns, in fact, all the guns I know about were either shotguns or single shot guns that took reloading at every bullet.
But not shotguns in the modern sense.
No.
Blunderbusses into which you would pack all kinds of things. You know, lead shot.
And I don't know nails. About blunderbusses, but yes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
You'd pack all kinds of stuff in there, and you'd ram your little wad of fabric in there and your powder, and you'd tamp it all down, you know, and you shoot once, and then you got to reload, and that takes, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, whatever.
I have no idea how fast it can be done, but it can be done.
But it's important to talk about this, because that's what constituted a firearm in the Revolutionary period. There were a few cannons around.
Oh, quite a few.
Yeah, but so few as to be negligible. I mean, those few that existed were in the hands of the British government, such as it was, and in the hands of certain wealthy colonial personages who had them for whatever reason. But
well,
there weren't very many.
There was also state weapons. Don't forget, the state of Massachusetts, the state of New York, not then called states, colonies.
The
also
militia.
Also had militias, which included firearms, which included cannon.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up the word militia, because that's incredibly important in this context as well. The colonial United States did not have an official military aligned with the British Empire. There were, from time to time, British troops quartered in the colonies for a range of reasons, but there was no standing military attached to the colonies.
Well, and we also had several wars, small wars, waged by the British against the Native Americans in certain contexts, King Philip's War, and then we had the war, basically a war against the French to clean the French out of the Ohio River Valley,
right,
and to create the Canadian colony of Great Britain.
Yes, and it's important to understand that for the purposes of waging these small-scale conflicts, as well as for the purpose of self-defense, and let's be perfectly frank, for the purpose of seizing more land from Native Americans.
Well, and also, very importantly, and we tend
to... Wait, let me finish real
quick. Okay, go ahead.
We didn't have standing army. We had these loose militia of citizens who, with their own arms, who would be called up for service whenever the need arose.
Right.
Yeah.
But also crucially important, because I really want to make this clear, the two main rationales for keeping and bearing arms at that time, maybe three if you include opposition to England, but the two really major reasons were Indian and Native American resistance to genocide and the control of African Americans, who were at that point, all of them virtually, for very few exceptions, slaves.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And you're right to bring that up, too. The modern American police force, as we understand it, is a direct descendant of the fugitive slave bands that would patrol the South.
Right. In fact, it was a requirement of any landholder in the South that he, not she, serve in the militias at crossroads to stop runaway slaves or slaves who were out without permits. So it was a whole system, a whole structure to destroy the freedom of persons of color.
Yes.
I think it's very important to understand that origin, because we're really seeing, I believe, the last hurrah of that kind of racism in the police today. And we're seeing it in communities of outrage where psychotics with multiple weapons are able to gain access to places from which they can shoot and kill many, many people with automatic or semi-automatic weapons.
Yes, you use the term psychotic, and that evokes, conjures up a certain image. And Okay, that's fine. But I also would like to submit that the prevalence of semi-automatic assault weapons in our culture makes it easier for people who might not be considered psychotic by the popular definition to unleash mass death. It makes it that much easier for somebody who's angry or damaged from past trauma or from childhood abuse or from whatever. It makes it that much easier to bridge that gap between intent and action. And when you're talking about assault weapons, action means the deaths of literally dozens of people at a time, if not hundreds.
You know, I also want to mention a very indicative thing. When this last slaughter took place in Texas at this little church in a very small town, was decimated in this slaughter, by the way. During that, and from the beginning of the reporting of it, they never mentioned the race of the killer, which immediately told me that he was white.
Exactly.
And that's really, really indicative, very right. important.
They also didn't use the word terrorist or terrorism, which also tells you the perpetrator is white.
Right, right. And yeah. And the bombing in Oklahoma City, another example of ignored terrorism.
Yeah.
From the right.
So looking at what constituted a firearm during the Revolutionary period, what constituted, for all intents and purposes, the colonial military apparatus, the civilian militias. I don't think that anybody, if they're being emotionally, intellectually honest with themselves, can say that the founding fathers, and there were no founding mothers, as you like to point out, nobody can say that the founding fathers intended for the people of the United States to own weapons that allow slaughter on an industrial scale. And that's what we're talking about here. The assault weapons, modern assault weapons that you can buy here in Portland, if you want one.
I can?
Yes. Are an industrial product. They are designed to kill people on an industrial scale. You can squeeze off many, many rounds per minute, even more so if you have one of those bump stocks you were talking about.
Yeah,
earlier.
Bump stocks.
This is a far cry from the single-shot muzzle-loading rifles and blunderbusses of the colonial period.
Well, I'm not going to get into the blunderbuss conversation. Well,
yeah, I think people know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really difficult to read the framers' intent into the context of the weapons that are available today.
Well, let's hear from our listening audience. After all, this is Talk Radio. Again, the number 231-8187. Who's on the air? Sean, you're with us.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
It's been, I think, about 100 years since the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes,
and a lot
yes
of people
exactly.
Don't realize,
I believe they're celebrating it now, and I think they even played the Communist Internationale on
I caught
cable.
That. Yeah. Yeah, I caught that. A lot of people don't remember, though, that there was revolution in Russia, but there was also, there was almost a revolution in Germany right around the same time. I think it was Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg.
Yes,
and
who were murdered.
Rosa Luxemburg, I believe, wrote an incredibly famous essay called Socialism or Barbarism. And I would just like to say, welcome to barbarism. You know, I think we're witnessing, you know, this dramatic economic inequality and the stress that people are facing. This has a lot to do with why, you know, we're seeing these shootings. There's a book called The Spirit Level by Richard Wilkinson. It's all about, you know, how economic equality is healthier for people and leads to healthier outcomes. And it just seems like limousine liberals don't realize how creepy they sound when they go on and on and on about gun control, when for the last 50 years in this country, we've had deunionization, deregulation, deindustrialization. And so, you know, a lot of populations in our country, a lot of citizens have been catching hell for hundreds of years. But now for the last 50 years, with this process going on, you know, now poor people of all races are catching a lot of hell. And I think it's creepy and callous sounding to talk about gun control when we have this grotesque economic inequality and such mass injustice. I mean, this is what Rosa Luxemburg, I think, was talking about, you know, socialism or barbarism. Well, You want more of this? Welcome to barbarism.
Well, there's certainly enough room in our discourse to discuss both things, I would imagine. And I also take issue with your use of the term limousine liberal, and that's a pejorative that suggests the only people complaining about these things are well-heeled leftists who are able to do so from a safe reserve, from a distance, as it were. When there's a lot of people, some of whom are related to or close to people who have died at the hands of gun violence, who are out there making the same argument, and they're anything but limousine liberals.
Well, and I think it's really important to understand that the analysis that's taking place in the popular culture today does not take into account the fact that the old-style working class, men and women who really had immense skills but were working people, often on the line, these jobs are disappearing. They're disappearing in two ways. They're disappearing overseas where labor is cheaper, but more important probably is that technology has caught up and passed this, so that we have now machines making machines. And that means that a lot of people cannot get a living wage job. I think that's important. Think of the frustration of a person who is the primary breadwinner, man or woman, facing a situation like is happening today. There's not only not a guarantee, but there's a deep likelihood that a person who could complete a four-year college degree in, let us say, something like the humanities, which are being discouraged now, by the way, in the universities, and be unable to find anything beyond pouring coffee.
Yeah, that's a travesty in its own right, certainly. But the caller, thank you for the call, by the way. The caller's right that there is a very pressing conversation that needs to take place in this country on the socialism versus barbarism question. But I disagree that conversation squeezes out a discussion about gun control.
No, I think that there's a whole host of issues that are opened up by what's happening. But the most significant one is also the one that helps to explain the success of the rise of the Donald Trump-ish, like, let's call it Trumpism, a weird philosophy of contradictions that is dominating the politics of Washington, D.C. to a great extent. And that contradiction is the notion that somehow people justified in their lives by hard work and real commitment to their families and to their country, as it were, suddenly find themselves disenfranchised effectively. And this has been a problem for a long, long time. Meanwhile, the Republican Party, as it exists today, is engaging in systematic disenfranchisement of persons of color and of frequently of poor communities throughout the United States. And this is going on at a very rapid pace, and will probably continue to go on. I'm not sure what the outcome of the elections, midterm elections, will be in 18. I'm not sure what the presidential elections thereafter will be, but I'm pretty sure that they will be a distortion of the actual needs and situations of most Americans.
I think that's pretty accurate.
I can guess
that. Yeah, I think so. All right, who's next? Harvey, good morning.
Hi, Joe and Paul. I have an idea that
Joe
might
and Abe.
Help. I have an idea that might help to reduce the easy access to guns.
Yeah.
The media is constantly telling us that there are two major things that injure and kill a lot of people, and they are cars and guns. And the difference between them is that cars are insured, but guns are not. Because the gun companies are a for-profit industry, they'll make sure that people who own guns are fully registered, screened, and held responsible for their actions. And I believe that gun insurance would be a good first step.
So you'd have to buy gun insurance if you owned a gun? Is that the idea?
Yes, because no one knows more about death and destruction than the insurance industry. It's their bread and butter, and that's what they're good at. And so this would be a first good step in bringing the murder situation under control.
That's an interesting idea. So you'd put a monetary cost on actually owning a gun in addition to the purchase of the weapon and its ammunition, which would be the insurance against your going crazy and killing people.
That's right.
Okay.
Because, you know, we the taxpayers picked up about $22 billion over the last few years in medical costs, plus the cost of people who, once they're injured, you know, they can't work anymore. They go on social welfare. Their families are on social welfare. We're talking of hundreds of billions of dollars spent, taxpayer dollars, that could be better spent on social services, rebuilding infrastructure, you name it. And here it's coming out of our pockets. So I think that this could be we could take the single-payer health care plan away from the insurance companies and in turn give them gun insurance as a substitute. And I think that they would do very well with gun insurance, and we would have single-payer health care plan.
You know, that's a really interesting proposition. And I would imagine under this scenario that if you wanted to own a semi-automatic military-grade assault weapon, that your insurance premiums would be rather substantial.
Yes, they would.
Yes, they would.
Well, I think it's an interesting idea, and I think it's never going to happen. But I do appreciate the concept. I think it has the morbid advantage of being a capitalist.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for the call. Yeah, I love the ideas that our callers throw at us.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of great ideas. The problem is that the system as it is as it is.
Yeah, it is as it is. Another idea I've seen tossed around recently, actually not that recently, it seems it gets tossed around after every one of these events, which are becoming so common in American life. You know, what if gun ownership and use faced anything close to the amount of regulation that driving a car does?
In other words, you have to have training. And,
yes, you have to be of a minimum age. You have to show that you're of sound mind and body. You have to be able to pass a written exam, a practical exam. You have to have insurance, and you have to periodically go back and do it all again.
That's like Germany.
No, it's not.
No, it is like Germany today.
Oh, it is like Germany today.
Yeah, yeah. I'm serious.
You were invoking. Oh, it's like the Germans.
Contemporary.
The Germans do it like this.
Never mind that. Right. Contemporary Germany.
Okay, like contemporary Germany. Yeah, it makes a whole lot of sense. But the likelihood of that is, you know, so remote as to be vanishing.
Well, in fact, the likelihood of reasonable gun reform with the enormous power of the manufacturers and distributors of those weapons and of the National Rifle Association, which is a crazy but popular organization, who I even know some liberals who joined it for various reasons during the period of struggle during the Vietnam War, the likelihood of somehow breaking the back of that powerful lobby seems very slim to me, because it's a non-starter when you're trying to get people to vote for you.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Not to mention the fact that the Supreme Court has ruled that money equals speech.
Right.
So the NRA is exercising its First Amendment rights in order to make sure that the Second Amendment remains pristine.
And that the Second Amendment is an anachronism, not perceived as such.
No, definitely not perceived as such. And let's not forget the grim icing on this cake of corpses.
That's a nice image. Grim icing on the cake of corpses.
Every time.
Icing made of blood.
Every time one of these massacres takes place.
Yes.
The profits of gun manufacturers jump. Right. The share values of gun making corporations jump. Because people are afraid that against all available evidence and against all historical precedent, that somehow the government's going to take away their guns.
Right.
It's nauseating.
Well, it doesn't make me nauseous. It makes me wryly and sadly amused. Let's hear from the rest of our callers. 231-8187.
Who's Anita? Good morning.
Good morning. I, speaking of elections and the system as it is election day, and I think it's important for us to remember that in such minor ways as we do have power to exercise through the system, it's really important to do it. There are important races on your side of the river. There's a desperately important race on the north side of the river where I am, the port commissioner's race, where Don Orange is running against the oil terminal that's been proposed.
Okay, could you say his name again?
Don Orange is the good guy trying to keep the oil terminal from happening.
Okay, and this is in Vancouver.
That's right.
Okay.
And you know of races there that are really important and may not immediately have an impact on gun violence and all the other things wrong, but at least perhaps we can fix some of the things that are wrong right now.
No, I'm glad you called. It is a very important issue. And I want to just add very quickly that in our part of the world, the Portland Community College has a measure which would just continue an existing tax on people for education. And it has been attacked by a weird right-wing guy who wrote a couple of very weird things in the voter pamphlet. But it's there's a, It's a great danger, a really serious danger, that people, this being a small election hereabouts, might not participate. And oddly enough, this reasonable educational measure would fail. And I don't want that to happen. So if you haven't voted, today's the day. You're going to have to bring it in. There's no other way. And thank you for the call.
Yeah, definitely don't want people to forget that this is, in fact, an election day.
It is.
Yeah. Okay. Let's pause for just a moment.
We're going to pause for just a moment.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program. I'm Abe. That's Joe over there. We're
talking about...
You're Joe.
I'm Joe.
We're talking about yet another massacre by gun in the United States. Yet another. Coming
little
up...
Little babies in the church pews shot.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that in just a minute.
Okay.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on alternative radio, Glenn Greenwald looks at the erosion of civil liberties brought on by the so-called war on terror. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, D.M.A. Roberts welcomes the creatives behind two plays currently running at the Profile Theater, Water by the Spoonful and The Happiest Song Plays Last. And at 11:30, Art Focus speaks to the director of the Northwest Film Center about animating life, the art, science, and wonder of Laika, running now through May at the Portland Art Museum. All this and more coming up today on your community-supported radio station. The number to call to take part in this conversation, 503-231-8187. You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. And also over Twitter, which goes criminally unused in this program, at HonestAbe72.
You're promoting Twitter?
I am, yes.
You understand? Never mind.
I hear you can become president if you tweet a lot.
Well, you can you can be an embarrassment to the world if you tweet a lot. pardon me.
Let's look at the particulars of this shooting, and we'll talk about some of the arguments, mostly the same old arguments that are being trotted out by the pro-gun rights crowd in the wake of yet another mass casualty event. This took place, as everybody knows, in a church. We know that the assailant terrorized the congregation inside of the church by shooting up the exterior before he entered. Now, every time one of these things happens, gun rights advocates say, oh, if only gun laws were looser so that there could have been some hero, packing heat, who could have stood up and taken the bad guy down.
Well, actually, I think in Texas there could have been.
In Texas, there could have been. Texas is, by most state standards, an incredibly lax place when it comes to gun laws. Texas is an open carry state, which means you can walk down the street with a revolver strapped to your hip, just like in the old days.
Well, AK-47, for that matter.
Yes, you can walk into a place of business with an assault rifle slung over your shoulder. And I remember there were some folks who did that during the last presidential campaign to sort of make some sort of statement of some kind. So Texas, if you're looking for a place to put this, guy with a gun and a white hat hypothesis into action, Texas would be the place to do it. Once again, we didn't see that come to pass.
Well, it's true. But one of the things to remember is that the history, the popular history, the movie picture history of Texas is not at all the history of Texas. And the history of Texas is the history of an extension of slavery. The history of Texas is the unfair war against Mexico that seized a third of Mexico. The history of Texas is essentially the slaughtering of Native American cultures. The history of Texas is violent, it is crude, and it is about the dominance of capital, both land capital, as in the cattle raising industry, and of course the oil industry. And Texas is totally in the hands at this point of these very reactionary monopoly capitalists.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of that.
So, so it is a living lie, the romance of Texas. And 10-gallon hat, no cattle.
All hat, no cattle?
All hat, yeah, no cattle, right. Okay, anyway.
So as it turns out, one of the few places in Texas that you're not allowed to openly carry a weapon is in a church.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, so, God will protect you.
Well,
no, I guess not.
I'm glad you brought that up, and I want to get to that in just a second. So I'm waiting to hear the argument. Well, now we should open up churches, clearly, to allow people to possess weapons.
It would make the preachers be a lot more careful.
Yeah, it probably would.
Bad joke.
Yeah. So every time one of these massacres happens, we throw these arguments around. Well, what can be done? We can't do anything. Here, have some thoughts and prayers. Here, have some sympathy. But no action is ever taken. And the refrain from the right, from conservatives, from gun rights advocates is always the same. You can't legislate morality. You can't legislate crazy. You can't legislate violence. Gun laws don't work.
Well, the president in idiocy, actually said that the problem is not guns. The problem is crazy people, said the crazy guy.
Said the crazy guy. Well, you know, he knows from what he speaks, right? Well, I'm here with some statistics right now.
Okay, go for
that it. Indicate that gun laws do, in fact, save lives and reduce gun homicides. I'm looking at a chart here put out by Slate, slate.com. All of the states that have the highest incidence of gun mortalities per 100,000 population are, not coincidentally, all of the states with the loosest gun laws. Louisiana, Mississippi, Arizona, Kentucky, Wyoming, Alaska, Missouri, Kansas, Alabama, on and on and on.
Yeah, but no, wait, there's a demographic issue here.
Let's get to that in a minute.
Okay, go ahead.
At the other end of the scale, those states with the lowest incidence of gun homicide are all the states with the strictest gun control legislation.
For example?
Massachusetts, Hawaii, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, California. And on and on and on.
Okay.
Oregon falls right about in the middle of the pack. We have moderate gun laws, and we're towards little bit towards the lower end of the mortality scale.
Ah.
So that argument is false, that better, more strict gun control legislation prevents deaths. The evidence is in. They do prevent deaths, these laws.
Uh-huh.
So that's my rebuttal to the gun rights crowd. But that's going to fall, of course, on deaf ears.
Well, it not only falls on deaf ears, it also is irrelevant to the argument because the anger.
It's not well, irrelevant.
No, let me finish. The argument is not a rational argument. The discourse is not a rational discourse. This is about a sense of aggrievance, of badness in one's life. This is a representation of, I'm going to say this because I don't know how else to put it, the extension of the male reproductive organ into the wide, wide world of ordinary discourse.
Penile inadequacy. Feelings of penile inadequacy are driving gun massacres.
I think so.
Huh.
I actually do. I think if I'm going to make any kind of Freudian analysis on this at all, that would be it.
Hmm.
And I'm not going to defend it because I don't know how you'd come up with data on such on such an idea. But the point is that in our society, the notion of the powerful family man, however false that notion has always been and certainly is now, that notion prevails and is a defining characteristic of our mythos about American men.
And is this the demographic question you were referencing a few moments ago?
Well, I mean, it's really an obvious thing. When you lose jobs, when you lose consequently lose status as the head of the family, when you are faced with a severe economic recession or reaction, when you are seeing the world changing very rapidly and you not being a part of that, where you don't have the training to keep up or whatever, this is a deeply enraging. And that enragedness, whether or not you have a gun law, by the way, that enragedness takes a form that can be incredibly violent.
Yes, but if you have a gun law that makes it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to obtain an assault weapon, then maybe you've got a way to short-circuit that and stop something before it escalates.
Oh,
to this
I agree, absolutely. I don't think it is. The question of the right to keep and bear arms really should stop long before the question of automatic or semi-automatic weapons.
So you're arguing that the emotional driver behind gun violence is the same aggrieved white masculinity that is the emotional driver behind conservative politics?
Yes, basically. You're oversimplifying and so am I.
Two sides of a coin,
yes.
As it were.
Yeah.
Hmm.
No, I think so. I think that, you know, I think also the whole mythology of that denies the existence of monopoly capitalism and the international market and the role, for example, of Russia in our politics, all these things are denied. And in that denial, you get a kind of hyper-nationalism, which includes within its rubrics the idea of the right to keep and bear arms, regardless.
Hmm. Let's see what our callers think.
Okay.
Damien, good morning.
Hey, how's it going? Good morning.
What's on your mind?
You guys are Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys have some definitely some valid points there, and I think, first of all, my thoughts and prayers go out to all the people that have been damaged by the recent events and the families, everything, so that's terrible. Two things I'd like to interject in your conversation. One is, I noticed that during Barack Obama's tenure in office, we really didn't tamp down on the massive amount of arms being sent overseas to all the other countries around the world. And
Massive amount of what? I'm sorry, say again?
The massive amount of arms shipments.
Oh, arms shipments, yes.
So, on one side, you know, we're really vocal about reducing the amount of arms that the Americans can have or possess via what you call automatic weapons, which are really semi-automatic weapons. But I don't hear anyone talking about the massive amounts of shipments going overseas to the other countries and third world countries.
Well, that's one of our major businesses. In fact, Trump, just yesterday, ignoring the treaty that we, at the end of World War II, made with Japan, where we promised to defend them and we told them they couldn't have an army, ignoring that whole thing, he's going to be selling a whole bunch of modern weapons, he hopes, to the Japanese to allow them to protect themselves, presumably from what? China, but more importantly, North Korea.
So then the other thing is whatever legislature that, I don't consider myself a Republican or a Democrat, but whatever legislature, you know, everyone wants to fight it out and get rid of semi-automatic weapons, you guys are going to have to hurry up and do that fast, because we're on the cusp of people making this stuff in their own house by pressing a button. So,
what, you're saying plastic guns or what? What are you saying?
No, I'm talking metal guns being made on little metal machines.
Oh.
And being industrial set, you know, industrial capabilities, that stuff is already on the market. It's going to be like having a microwave in your house. You're going to be able to pump these things out as many as you want. And, you know, it's not going to, more and more laws are not going to change it. Like, it's a mental health issue. And I'm not a pro-Trump guy. I was for maybe a week, like I am for every president after he's elected, before he starts doing things that he's not supposed to. But what I do have to say is, he's right in the fact that it's a mental health issue, because in the future, you're not going to be able to stop it. No matter, you know, these felons don't care whether it's illegal. This guy was already a felon. He was already doing things he shouldn't.
Finish your thought.
You've got to stop a different way, and that's providing for the families, providing for the system, you know, make our monetary policy sound, and... you know, just take care of your neighbor.
Now, I want to respond to that first by saying, I think that you're absolutely right that a much more robust and effective mental health care system in the United States would go a long way towards reducing the incidence of these mass shootings. But we just finished sharing with you data that indicate that stricter gun laws do in fact result in a lower rate of death by firearms.
I think I want to say something here. I think it's important to distinguish between what data itself shows, which is indisputable, but beyond that, to realize that the incidents are individual. That is, the guy who shot up the church, he had a deep grievance within his own family. He had already been dishonorably discharged from the Air Force, I believe it was, and the Air Force failed to tell local authorities that he shouldn't have assault weapons. So that there are a lot of ways in which people fall through the cracks, as well as ways which are legitimate and will allow a lot of people to kill a lot of people.
My number one thing is, with my issue with a liberal standpoint and the talking points are, you know, practice what you preach. What we do overseas and what goes on across the world, that's important too.
Yeah.
And when your president gets in office and that doesn't change at all, then when something happens at home, you just flood the airwaves and just want to take away people's, you know, protection.
So I'm not clear on what you're saying. Are you saying you want to keep the Second Amendment just like it is or not?
I'm saying you can't, it doesn't matter. You're going to put people in two different, basically, clans or clubs. You're going to have people that are going to keep their guns no matter what you do. And then you're going to have people that give their guns away. They're not, the Second Amendment people, it's not something that you can just go on the radio and say, hey, we're going to do this and this is going to happen. No one is going to go along with it. And then they're going to be, people are going to be making these things in their house.
Well, what I understand your point, and your argument apparently is that there will be technology that allow regular guns to be manufactured at home, which I think, let me finish. I think that's a little bit dubious in and of itself because it's going to be expensive at the very least.
No, it exists already. It's on the market already.
It is.
Yes. You can buy an AR-15 for $200. Okay.
I feel a lot better knowing that. Okay.
So, I've been in the gun industry for a while. I recently I got out of it because it was too expensive for me to carry my insurances. I was paying a lot in taxes, and operating by the book, I was a small-time manufacturer, and so I was just making 22 pistols for competition shooting. But I went to a lot of the gun shows around Portland. I've been around these people, and they are good people, and they abide by the laws. But the crazies, of course, give everyone a bad name. Now, I can tell you for a fact that once any legislature comes down the pipeline, like a magazine ban or anything like that, people are not going to comply because it's technically illegal. So, everyone wants to interpret it, the right to bear arms, go back and forth. At the end of the day, the people that feel strongly about protecting their families are going to do exactly what they feel.
How do you feel? I'm curious about this. How do you feel about the statistical evidence that you're more likely to shoot yourself or your family member owning a gun than to shoot a bad guy or gal?
So you like taking a broad paintbrush across everyone's face?
That's an established statistical fact that most gun-related homicides are committed by people who are family members or close relations.
So my rebuttal of that is, do you think that everyone should have self-driving cars because people get in accidents?
I don't think that's an effective rebuttal to that question.
Don't care if you do or not. I'm just saying you can pull statistics out everywhere, but it doesn't apply to everyone. So the people that those statistics don't apply to, that are responsible people, they don't care. You understand that?
I do.
So we need to find a middle ground. Democrats, Republicans, everyone needs to find a middle ground. And realize that guns are actually obsolete. The new technology coming down the pipeline, it makes firearms a relic of the past. So all they have to say
are you talking about what laser pistols and lightsabers?
Do what you can as fast as possible to take people's guns away because the genie has left the bottle. You can make these things in your house. The crazies can make these things.
Well, I think we have to make a distinction here between, we really need to make a distinction.
And, thank you for the call. I think we're going to leave it there.
I think we need to make a distinction between that which is statistically and rationally true and those exceptions which will appear inevitably. To make a law against semi-automatic and automatic weapons will not mean that people will turn in, get rid of those weapons. There's so many of them out there. But to make such a law changes the normative expectations about gun carrying and gun behavior. You're not going to be able to deal with the frustrations coming out of interpersonal relations. You're not going to be able to deal with the economic inequalities. None of these things will be resolved by changing the Second Amendment. But the number of people randomly killed, and I do mean randomly, will be significantly reduced, and we have stats that prove it. That's all I have to say about that.
And the caller makes an important point, which is to say that regardless of their legal status, firearms are omnipresent in American society. There are more guns than there are people in the United States.
So everybody's like two gun?
I don't know if there's quite that many, but there's more guns than people. And interestingly, these guns tend to be concentrated in a relatively small number of hands, meaning that if you own a gun, statistically, you probably own more than one. But nevertheless, the question then becomes, it's a question of harm reduction, I think, at that point.
Yes.
These things are out there. So what can we do to make sure that fewer people are harmed by them? In a similar approach that some countries have taken towards things like drugs and prostitution.
Yeah.
That's my take on it anyway.
Okay.
All right. John writes into the Facebook page to say, in addition to the insurance and training, I would like to see cradle-to-grave registration of every weapon, recording every transfer of ownership like motor vehicles. One who sells a weapon sends in the document of transfer. One who gifts a weapon sends in the document of transfer. One who destroys a weapon sends in the document of its destruction. If it's stolen, it must be reported immediately. Until then, the registered owner is still liable, just like a motor vehicle.
I actually like that
idea. I like that, too.
But But here's the problem. If you believe, as quite a few people do, that the state is inherently the enemy of the people, then registration becomes the weapon of the state against the people. That's a psychologically significant idea.
In the context of guns, that sentiment that the state is the inherent enemy of the people is folly. Why? Because it comes to a throwdown battle against the state. The state has tanks. The state has F-15s. The state has cruise missiles. You don't stand a chance against the state, even if you've got, you know, a basement full of assault rifles. There's no question.
Well, I'm not arguing with you in the matter of fact. I'm talking about the popular culture. There is this notion of the need constantly to be vigilant against the power of the state. This is part of our culture.
But that is a corrosive, destructive fantasy. This fantasy that, oh, if I stock up on guns, I'll be safe when the revolution comes, or when the government finally puts its fascist boot on my neck, I'll be armed to the teeth and be able to fight them off. No.
Well, I agree with you, but I'm pointing out not a fact of a physical sort, but a fact of social sort. It's a social reality that there is this mythos that has always survived, that it is us, that is the people, versus the state. This is part of our heritage.
Yes, it's a mythos, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones.
Well, we have lots of mythos. Well, I want to make it clear. We have lots of mythos. Some of them may or may not be true. A lot of us seem to believe in a mythical beast in the sky that is all powerful.
Yes, the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Yeah,
exactly. Praise be his name.
Yes.
All right, who's next? Barth, good morning.
Good morning, gents. I didn't catch the beginning of your show, much to my chagrin.
Neither did I, so that's okay. Go ahead.
Anyway... A couple of points. You said concealed open carry was forbidden in churches in Texas.
That's my understanding,
Does that mean concealed carry is also forbidden? There is a nuance there that should be touched upon.
Well, no, you're right, but I don't know the answer.
You keep talking. I'll see if I can figure out the answer.
Go ahead.
Fair enough. Fox News reported that the church killer killed himself because he was being followed or harangued by armed citizens after he left the church
I'm not sure why he killed himself. We'll never know that. He maybe intended to kill himself from the get-go. He was a very crazy person. But indeed, he was followed by guys, I believe it was, with guns.
Okay. It's a small thing, but I think it does make a difference. The person who was talking about insuring gun possession, it's an interesting idea, but I don't think it would fly. There's a couple of reasons. A lot of people believe that it's their right, and you know that's not the tangent I want to go off on, but the cost to own is ongoing, so it's going to be perceived as a tax versus any kind of safety thing. People who do these things, mass killings, almost inevitably kill themselves at the end. So that seems like it's almost a perk because they could mess with the system and screw the insurance industry by checking out at the end.
Cheat the noose, as it were.
Yes. Gun owners more likely to kill themselves or family members statistically. Mm-hmm. One can make statistics say anything you want, and some of these are pretty skewed. You know, there was talking about the death of children statistic, and this ended up including lots of under 18 gang members, et cetera, that were killed in drug transaction related melees. But I'm not trying to.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm not sure what your point is here.
Well, the point is that if you want the statistics to tell you something, then that's how you skew your questions. I'm not sure that. If you took the cross section of gun owners, which is apparently pretty damn large in the country, and that most of them are tremendously law abiding, Many of these guns never get used, never even get taken out of safes or cases.
Hopefully in safes, but often not, unfortunately.
Well, okay, but they out of storage in whatever way, you know, and people who have a bunch of guns often just have a bunch of guns because they like guns and they will shoot them once in a while, or some of them are never fired. It's crazy, but it's true. So I think that if you include all of those numbers, that their families are not harmed by their collections or ownership. Their neighbors, their church members are not harmed by these things. And that's a really broad cross section of gun owners.
So are you saying in essence that all the guns that are out there don't matter in terms of life?
What I'm saying is that most firearms in private hands are never used for mayhem or...
Well, of course. I don't think anyone's arguing that owning a gun means that you're going to kill somebody or shoot somebody. I don't think that's the argument. I think the argument is when it's normative for people to have guns, I get angry. Let's say I have a partner, and I get angry at my partner, and I decide that he needs to be punished. Now, I might punch him in the face. I might refuse to make dinner. I might walk out of the house in a huff, drive off in my huff. I might do any number of things. But if I happen to have a gun handy and I happen to be in a mildly psychotic mood just for 5 seconds, somebody's going to end up hurt. And if the gun isn't there, they're not going to end up hurt in the same way. That's just all it is about, really, in this case, in this example.
All right, I think we're going to give some others a chance here. Thank you much for the call. Appreciate it. To answer the question at the outset of that call, according to the New York Times, in Texas, it is the option of a given church to decide if it is either a gun-free zone or a concealed carry zone.
Ah.
So that's up, I presume, to the pastor and the parishioners as to what sort of church they want to be.
Okay, who's next?
Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to bring up the issue of women and gun violence.
Good idea.
Yeah. I did a quick research on, you know, online while you guys have been talking. There's a group called Every Town for Gun Safety. It's on their website. They say that 57% of the mass shootings between January 2009 and June 2014, the perpetrator killed an intimate partner or family member. So that's 57, so that's half of the mass shootings between 2009 and 2014. Intimate partner violence or family member violence was part of the picture. And they also say that in states that require background checks for all handgun sales, 38% fewer women are shot to death by intimate partners.
That's really interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
That latter one particularly.
Yeah, so that we get a reduction in the number of women that are shot to death by intimate partners where there are good, really good background checks. They also make a bunch of suggestions about keeping guns out of the hands of abusive dating partners or convicted stalkers. They say that in 35 states, state law does not prohibit all people convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence crimes and all people subject to restraining orders from buying or using guns. So in other words, we need to strengthen state laws to prohibit people convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence crimes from buying or using guns. And stalkers, domestic abusers, 41 states don't require prohibited domestic abusers to relinquish guns they already own. So this is coming at it from the angle of how do we tighten the laws that are going to impact domestic violence against women. But it's also, and I think this theme has been running through the whole discussion today, this larger theme of the inordinate militarism and assumptions of domination in this culture. I wish everyone could turn into a Quaker here, but that doesn't seem very likely at the moment. But I wanted to bring up this issue of women and domestic violence and abuse I think it's a really important one.
No, I agree with you. I think this is maybe actually at the core of survival in our culture, particularly the use of violence is an ultimate weapon of terror against women in our culture, and that's something that must stop.
Yes, it's indeed. As a woman, I can say it must stop, as all forms of domestic violence and abuse against women must stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. Excellent call.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that any sort of domestic violence conviction whatsoever should void someone's Second Amendment rights for the rest of their life.
Ah, shut up. I'll slap you silly.
Oh, shh. All right. I have a possible solution to this problem
of gun violence. Okay.
It's not a cure, but it might mitigate the problem to a large extent. And that is, I would like to see federal government money put towards a massive buyback and meltdown of guns. Make it really worth someone's while to sell back their gun to the federal government. Now, there's going, of course, will inevitably be people who hang on to some of their guns. But if you make it a really attractive proposition, like, say, you know, thousands of dollars for your assault rifle, I think we'll see a lot of people carry their guns down to whatever office is carrying this out and have them melted down.
That's very possible, and particularly as people get poorer.
I
mean, you have a choice. You rob a bank or give the gun back and get money.
Right. And for people who say, oh, that'd be too expensive. Well, I don't think it would be all that expensive. Maybe we build one less aircraft carrier, one fewer aircraft carrier.
Can't have too many aircraft carriers. Hey, listen. Yeah. Guess what? We're out of time. This is KBOO and 90.7 on your FM. Take care. If you need to vote, vote. And Abe and I will be back next week.
See you next week.
But it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Big Waters Falling Up Tour, Tuesday, November 14th at 8 p.m. at the Paris Theater in Portland. Portland locals Big Water will be closing out their Falling Up Tour, featuring special guest Danielle Betancourt on the violin. Big Water will also be sponsoring a feeding for houseless people through AMA Global Care and the Paris Theater. Again, that's Big Water's Falling Up Tour, Tuesday, November 14th at 8 p.m. at the Paris Theater, 6 Southwest 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.